WBUR Boston, WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For the first time, the Bush administration has openly acknowledged the threat, the reality of global warming, but has stopped short of changing its environmental policies. If climate change is real, can anything, should anything be done to stop it? We begin tonight with new developments in the sex abuse scandal engulfing the Catholic Church. Next week, bishops will meet in Dallas to vote on a national policy for dealing with abusive priests. A draft of the proposed recommendations has been released to bishops. Monica Brady Meyeroff has been covering the church crisis for WBUR and has examined the documents. Earlier, I asked her what they say.
Well, there are many points made in this document. First and foremost, it says all allegations of abuse must be reported to civil authorities. So take it to the police. That's the first thing you should do. The next is to remove all priests who have abused more than one child in the past and those who abuse any child in the future. Defrock them. Take them out of the church. It also says to set up a diocesan review board to determine whether a priest who molested one child in the past can continue to serve under supervision and other conditions. And it also says that bishops should no longer enter into confidentiality agreements in settling lawsuits, recognizing that in the past this enabled sexual abuse to be repeated. So it recognizes a lot of the mistakes of the past and is trying to correct them.
The policy now is about past abuses. Seems to be two strikes and you're out. What is the moral difference between raping a child or molesting a child, one child, and molesting two? I mean, how do they sustain that difference?
Well, from what I read in the policy, it appears to center on the power of conversion, which is something we've heard the Pope talk about in the past. Reading from the proposal from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, it says, "We're mindful of the power of conversion about which the Holy Father speaks in his address. Regarding clerics with past offenses who have been treated, not diagnosed as pedophiles, and who have not committed more than one act of sexual abuse of a minor, their ministerial status must be considered by a diocesan review board." So what it's saying is, I think, with the power of conversion, these guys can be given a second chance. Now, this is sure to spark some controversy in Dallas, because here in the Boston Archdiocese, the new policy by Cardinal Bernard Law is zero tolerance. One strike and you're out. Past, present, future, you're out. And they're sticking by that. Today, the Archdiocese said they are going to take that policy to Dallas and try to convince the bishops that a policy that allows for possibly one isn't as bad as two and let's review it is not going to regain the trust of Catholics. And the policy just needs to be absolutely clear. Past and future, one strike and you're out.
Did this two strikes and you're out provision surprise people? What do they make of this? This looks like such a fudge. And after the Vatican meeting, the cardinals were criticized for fudging on similar issues.
I think it did. I think it's going to disappoint many people because one person who's been abused by a priest, could be damaged for life, and they probably won't take this policy. They probably won't be happy with it. Now, the Boston Archdiocese, as I said, is they didn't criticize this policy. Mm-hmm. Cardinal Law supports it, but they're going to Dallas with their policy, their zero tolerance policy in hand. So clearly, there's going to be some disagreement over it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this has to go to the Vatican for approval.
Right. If it passes with 2/3 majority at the meeting in Dallas, it'll then go to the Vatican.
And what do we know about that? How it's apt to be received?
Well, the Vatican has made some statements recently that indicate they might not agree with all these points. Recently, several top Vatican officials told the National Catholic Reporter that they don't agree with the step that would obligate bishops to report accusations to the police. Quoting from one high-ranking cardinal who's often mentioned as a successor to Pope John Paul II, he says, quote, "For me, it would be a tragedy to reduce the role of a pastor to that of a cop. We're totally different, and I'd be prepared to go to jail rather than harm one of my priests." This is something he said in Rome in May and was printed in the New York Times this past Sunday.
So he is suggesting that the Vatican may say, no, we won't go along with the policy of turning the stuff over to the police.
Right. And if the Vatican doesn't go along with the policy, that doesn't mean all of the bishops in the United States can't agree to follow it anyway.
I see.
But it does leave open to question what happens when bishops turn over, when it's 10 years from now, when it's 20 years from now. If it's not a mandatory policy, which would require the approval of the Vatican, some might feel it's just not strong enough. The Vatican also has to go along with really really improving how you defrock priests. Right now, it's a very long and cumbersome process. And if you were to put this new policy into place that says priests who've been accused of more than one child abuse accusation in the past or the future should be defrocked, I think they'd also better look at streamlining their process for defrocking priests.
It can take how long?
Months. Mm-hmm. And the priest can, petition to have it reviewed. And if a priest wants to be difficult about it, it can drag on for months, possibly years.
There was a case in Pittsburgh, as you know, where the bishop really went to the mat to get rid of somebody and did what cardinal law did not do.
That's right. I mean, it was amazing that the bishop had to do that, but the process wasn't happening quickly enough.
And it went through many Vatican hoops, but the Pittsburgh bishop stayed with it and got rid of this offender.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this report.
You're welcome.
Monica Brady Meyeroff is a reporter covering the crisis in the Catholic Church for WBUR. In an EPA report sent to the United Nations, the Bush administration acknowledged for the first time that human activity is behind climate change and that it is having a serious impact on the environment. But little of the White House policy toward global warming is expected to change. Today, indeed, the president dismissed his own administration's report and said he still opposes the Kyoto Treaty, which calls for mandatory reductions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. Where do you stand on the global warming debate? Are you ready, as the report recommends, to live with global warming? Or are you more optimistic that global warming can be prevented and perhaps reversed? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Palo Alto, California, is Stephen Schneider, professor of biological sciences with the Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Welcome, Professor Schneider.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on. I guess if you were to doing a movie version of this report, you could call it how we can learn to stop worrying and accept global warming.
Yeah, I was thinking also with all the Tolkien craze. What was the Hobbit's book There and Back Again? remember the president before he was president was actually talking about doing something about global warming, and then after he got in, got a fair amount of pressure from some of their stronger lobbyists and the vice president, and then reversed, and now it's moving back in the direction I think that may be more natural for his own beliefs.
Yes. Well, let's do this report. Let's take it more seriously than the president has, apparently, and ask what would a coping strategy be like? What would it call on us to do if we said, okay, we can't stop global warming, we can't reverse it, the best thing we can do is kind of give in to the inevitable and live with it? What would that be like?
Well, what they're talking about is adaptation. In an ideal world where everybody has perfect information, if we knew 20 or 40 years in advance that there was going to be substantial heating and increase in drought and flood frequencies in the corn-growing areas, well, actually everywhere, as is a typical projection for the next several decades, then we'd have time to modify our irrigation systems and our pumps, and we'd be able to start thinking about planting alternative crops that might be more able to handle that kind of variability. That's what they mean by adaptation. Of course, that isn't free. You know, dam systems and irrigation systems aren't free. We might also try to deal with the northward movement of malarial mosquitoes by saying, well, we'll just hit them with public health measures like pesticides. And that's not free either, because there's health damage from pesticides and they cost. So, yes, there are things that we can do to try to adapt, and indeed we should do things to try to adapt, but the notion that adaptation is going to be cheap and automatic is challenged by almost anybody who studies it carefully.
Now, the report emphasizes that there actually are some benefits to global warming, and it mentions increased agricultural and forest growth because the growing seasons would be longer. It says there would be more rainfall from and carbon dioxide for photosynthesis. What do you say? Are these benefits, how do they rank?
Well, it's absolutely right that there'll be distributions of winners and losers. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I'll get the listeners used to that, ITCC, which is the group of a couple of hundred scientists who every 5 years write a report after it gets 1,000 reviewers and three rounds of reviews, said exactly that most recently in their 2001 report, namely that there would be a distribution where some benefits would occur, in particular increased growing seasons might be helpful to some kinds of crops in the high latitudes. But the report made two other very important points. It said that most of those studies which suggested an increased productivity from CO2 and from longer growing seasons were based upon the assumption that there was no change in extreme events. That is, we weren't getting increased drought and flood frequencies, whereas the climate scientists themselves said that's part of the forecast. So therefore, it's quite possible that we may have overestimated the benefits, even where they might occur, because we have to also look at the, you know, at the range of other outcomes. But this is all part of the debate. The other problem is that after a few degrees of warming, said the reports, there are very few studies which show benefits anywhere. And almost all the studies show that the bulk of the losers tend to be poorer people in already hot countries and nature herself, because species do not know how to adapt by changing irrigation systems and putting different genetic crops out in the field. So the report was very clear that the average effect would be loss, although that does not mean there won't be individuals, particularly in high, cool latitudes in wealthier countries where there could be at least up to a few degrees warming.
Mm-hmm. Well, the report is actually candid on the costs. They say some of the goods and services lost through the disappearance or fragmentation of natural ecosystems are likely to be costly or impossible to replace. And they point to things like heat waves, the ending alpine meadows in the Rocky Mountains, and they say that some barrier islands, I don't know whether they mean off Cape Cod or Cape Cod, what they mean, are likely to disappear entirely. These are pretty big costs.
Now, those are part of the reason that a number of us have long worried about this problem. It's not because we were 99% sure that it was going to be, you know, catastrophic for everybody everywhere. That's certainly not possible for anyone to say that credibly, but because we can't rule out a number of nasty to even catastrophic outcomes all around, and therefore the issue is how much insurance do we buy to try to slow down this problem in order to reduce the likelihood of the more dangerous events and hope that we get lucky and that we end up on the mild side, but we can't assure anybody of that now. And we're not going to be able to, by any amount of research in the next few years, immediately solve this problem. It's way too complex to be able to pin down the precise answer over the time frame of the next 10 or 20 years.
And what is the Bush administration policy on global warming? Here they say it's a grave problem, it's happening. What are they doing, and what's their policy on it?
Well, their policy at first was just basically to dismiss the 10-year process, which in fact Senior Bush signed in Rio in 1992, and then the Clinton administration negotiated very painfully, I might add, with Europe and the developing world, the so-called Kyoto Protocol process. And that process had not reached a firm conclusion. The only thing it had suggested was that the richer countries should try to cut their emissions to something near or slightly below their 1990 levels, which would have been a substantial cut for the U.S. because we've grown a lot. Then the Bush administration came along and said, we're out of the process. Doesn't matter what we signed. Doesn't matter what Clinton signed. We're not going to do it because it costs us too much money. And the rest of the world looked at the country which has the largest emissions of any nation and the highest per capita opting out because of its own convenience. And we didn't look too good in the rest of the world. And as the Bush administration could tell you, if they tell you the truth, they've been getting tremendous pressure from all over the world, from people who find our reactions disingenuous.
And then briefly, they came up with a voluntary program, right?
Yeah, well, there was a voluntary program under the Clinton administration, too, that didn't work. And it's what the economists call the free rider problem. Why should anybody not ride for free if nobody's going to collect the fare from you when you step on the bus? And if you haven't got some rules and those rules aren't applied over a fairly wide number of players, it's very unlikely that people will participate unless they can get some benefit out of it. But before we get too pessimistic, let me say there are about 100 cities.
Hold the optimism, Professor Schneider, for just a minute. We're talking about global warming. Are you ready to live with it? At 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston,
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. The Bush administration says live with global warming. Nothing much can be done about it. What do you think about that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Professor Stephen Schneider, a professor of biological sciences with the Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Professor Schneider, I interrupted you. You were about to make an optimistic comment.
No, I said let's not all be pessimistic.
Yes.
That nothing can be done.
Yes.
Because there are about 100 cities. I don't have the exact number in the U.S. and maybe four or five times that in the world, who actually have climate plans. Now, how can a city have a climate plan?
Mm.
Because it's a country and a world activity. It turns out that most of these plans, I have a student who just studied this carefully, were not done for climate. They called them a climate plan. The main reason that people were going to more efficient buses, reduce their polluting cars, better power plants, energy efficiency programs in their cities, is because the actual amount of money they were investing in the efficient technologies was less than the fuel savings. And they got a second reason, what we call co-benefits. They were reducing air pollution, reducing congestion, and other factors. So already there's been a substantial movement locally in many cities across the U.S. and in the rest of the world that are ahead of their governments, because it turns out there are a lot of things you can do that make this problem better that don't cost you money but actually make you money by being more efficient. The problem is there are some losers, and those losers tend to be in the coal industry, the people who make the SUVs. It's going to be pretty tough for the inefficient to be able to do well if one is moving toward efficiency, and they know it. They're organized, and they're protesting, and the winners, which are mostly the rest of us diffused throughout society, don't know it and are relatively quiet.
Mm. And, of course, the notion of a clean environment in one city or one state just sort of beguiles belief. I mean, we're part of one climate.
Yeah, it helps, though, because it's the right frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that the disease of being a good citizen and doing well by doing good will spread from localities now, maybe up to the national level and then eventually international level. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's often how reform happens in the United States. We're joined now by David Doniger. He's a policy director of the National Resources Defense Council's Climate Change Policy at the Environmental Protection Agency. This was under President Clinton. David Doniger, hi. Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Thank well,
you.
Now, you...
I think you mixed me up in that
I did mix you up.
With the EPA,
yep.
And now with the Natural Resources Defense Council, all on climate change policy.
Very good. Thanks for that clarification. Now, let's just sort of set this report up. This report from the EPA was submitted to the United Nations. That was required by a treaty signed by the first President Bush, but it was simply posted on the EPA website with no fanfare. And when we asked the EPA to comment on it, they referred us to the State Department, which carried...
Well, let me say that...
Sorry?
This is not actually an EPA report, and it's an administration report.
All right, okay.
It was reviewed and approved by officials in the White House. When the president says that he dismisses this, he's dismissing the report approved by appointees of his own in the White House.
Well, that's what
this
I wanted
report
to...
Is,
yeah, that's what
report
I wanted
is
to...
prepared for the U.S. government as a whole.
Right.
And it's the State Department that presents it to the other parties to this 1992 treaty that Steve mentioned,
right.
The Rio
right.
Climate Treaty.
Yeah. Okay. So, but the president has now dismissed the report, saying it was prepared by the bureaucracy. What's going on here? I mean, they have a report. The White House signs off on it. The president says, no, that's not our report. How do you make sense of this? What are the political pressures here?
Yeah. Well, President Bush, as even before he became president, had difficulty with the science of climate change. On the one hand, he has wanted to say and has said that he takes climate change, global warming, very seriously. One of the first things he did, however, when coming into office, was to ask the National Academy of Sciences here in the United States to review the consensus report that Steve mentioned, the International Science Panel report, and with the objective, I think, that they hoped that the American scientists would say these international scientists didn't produce good work. Instead, the National Academy of Sciences completely endorsed the work of the international panel. And so there the administration found last June that the American scientific consensus was the same. And he has the problem on his hands of global warming science saying you've got a serious problem and an unwillingness on his part to cross the energy industry and deal with the solutions. But we have solutions, and they're quite straightforward, and they would allow us to slow down global warming and to eventually reverse it, to limit the damage that now the president's own government admits is going to happen.
Well, yeah, we want to get to the possible solutions, but help us figure out how it is that he can commission he commissions a panel. The panel says it's happening. The report is signed on off by his own White House, and then he dismisses the report. Is this just incoherence? Did no one tell the president, or what's going on?
There is some playing now to an outraged right-wing base. Mm-hmm. There are organizations and radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh professed to be outraged yesterday to find that the president and his administration would recognize the consensus of climate science and stop listening to the few that Rush Limbaugh listens to.
Of course, of course, Rush Limbaugh. Now, you mentioned what we could do. Give us a brief three things that we could do to prevent and perhaps even arrest global warming.
Sure. The biggest source of carbon dioxide in the United States is electric power plants. Mm-hmm. They produce 40% of all the carbon dioxide that the United States as a whole emits. And it's within grasp to place reasonable emission limits on carbon dioxide and then three other more normal air pollutants, conventional air pollutants, the ones that cause acid rain, ozone smog, and also mercury contamination of our lakes and our fish. If you put the four pollutants together in a package, set limits for the electric power industry, it'd be quite reasonable and quite achievable to reduce the carbon dioxide levels back to 1990 levels, way below today's levels, and to do it over the next few years. Senator Jeffords in Vermont is the leader of a growing group of senators that are sponsoring this, and he's likely to move this legislation in the Environment Committee this month. Is something actually that President Bush was for
during the campaign.
And then when he got elected and came into office, heavy-duty lobbying occurred from the coal industry and the coal-using electric utilities and the railroads that move the coal. And he knuckled under rather quickly, saying, no, I'm really actually against regulating carbon dioxide from power plants. Mm-hmm. But it would be quite affordable and quite doable, and we really know how to do it. Second thing is automobiles. Mm-hmm. The California state legislature right now is considering legislation that would have tailpipe emissions of carbon dioxide reduced. The state of California is the only one allowed, other than the federal government, under our clean air laws, to set auto emission standards. Mm-hmm. And California has been the leader many times. Mm-hmm. We are working to pass this legislation, and then other states could copy it, and mm-hmm. hopefully the country mm-hmm. as a whole would copy
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Almost every clean air standard for automobiles mm-hmm. that we have not only in this country but around the world was pioneered in California.
Mm-hmm. And California could be pioneering new standards. Let's
exactly.
take some calls. Mike is on the line. Welcome.
Yes, hello. This is Mike.
Yes,
glad
welcome.
To be on the show.
Thank you.
I just think it's incredible how the Bush administration has downplayed and ignored the science that really documents, you know, the happening of global warming. I guess when I think about Bush, I think about the fellow who's leading South Africa now and the World AIDS crisis. I mean, the fellow running South Africa denies the existence of AIDS, despite the overwhelming, challenge in his country and the world consensus that AIDS is a real living, disease and problem. And here, global warming is happening, and George Bush denies the National Academy of Science. Just doesn't want to do anything, is ignoring reality, and it just looks really bad. And I just can't believe that we're witnessing this event.
But Stephen Schneider, actually, isn't this report which says global warming is happening, human beings are largely responsible, isn't this a Bush's admitting, or at least some part of the administration admitting, that this is a real problem?
Sure, I think that's exactly right. I also agree with Mike that it's been pretty incredible. But you have to divorce the administration, by which I mean the West Wing, the political group, from the administration, which is the from one administration to the next scientists. They can dismiss them as bureaucrats, but these are the people in the government who actually know something about these problems. Scientists who work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA and EPA and Department of Energy and Agriculture and all those agencies who've been studying this in some cases for 30 years. And they're the ones who tend to write these reports, and they are the ones who tend to be the most scientifically credible, and they do not generally represent a political point of view. And there's some massaging that White House has put on these reports, but they can only massage so far. And I haven't actually seen the disavowals that were reported today. But remember, when we say that Bush, may not be acting rationally about that information, it depends what you're being rational for. If he's being rational about worrying about big campaign contributions from certain interests, he is being rational and being in denial. It's just not rational from the perspective of those of us who would put the health of the life support system of the Earth first. And his behavior, of course, is not untypical of that of many political leaders, and part of the reason why that job is viewed with such cynicism by the public.
Yes, and we have to point out that the Senate was almost unanimously against the Kyoto Treaty, so it's not just President Bush.
Well, that's not exactly true. The Senate took a position on what should be in it, and much of what the Kyoto Protocol contained in the end is what the Senate ordered up. Mm-hmm. So this was a made-in-America treaty. It was written to U.S. Specifications, and the sad thing is that the president cavalierly walked away from it. Now we have to focus on what we can do here at home. Mm-hmm. And since the president is not likely to initiate, the initiative has to come from the Congress and from states. The state of Massachusetts has already passed a four-pollutant power plant cleanup plan. Mm-hmm. So this can be done at the state level and at the congressional level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, the U.S. walking from Kyoto may in the long run be more expensive for us rather than cheaper, despite their rhetoric, because part of the negotiation at Kyoto, and pushed very hard by the U.S., was that countries should not have to make all their emission cuts at home. If they could find it cheaper to go out and, for example, buy China a gas-burning power plant instead of a coal power plant that China would have built instead, that would be a much cheaper investment than, say, retiring a coal-burning power plant in the Ohio Valley that hasn't finished its economic life. And we call this clean development mechanism. It was very controversial. It was opposed by a lot of environmental groups and by European Greens, yet it was part of that negotiation. So if there's a Kyoto and the U.S. is not playing, what the smart companies and countries are going to do is they're going to go out in the world and they're going to find the cheapest ways to cut first. Mm-hmm. And if we eventually get in the game, which we undoubtedly will as this program continues to build our credibility and weather events that that drive it through the media, like super hurricanes and heat waves and so forth, move and change public opinion more than anything we scientists say. When that eventually happens and we join in, let's say 5 or 10 years from now, a lot of the cheapest opportunities will already have gone to Europe and to Japan and other places. So in a way, a lot of our own industries are not happy about this decision because we're not getting in on the ground floor of the cheapest solution.
Sure. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hello.
How's it going?
Well, just fine. Welcome.
Thank you. This is, albeit somewhat of a Band-Aid, but maybe it kind of buys us some time as we go through the final legs of the fossil fuel era. But I was wondering if anyone's ever looked into how much volcanoes contribute to the mitigation of global warming and whether we couldn't induce some volcanoes to erupt, hopefully in a place where it has minimum impact on people's lives, throw some dust up in the air and kind of offset some of these the chemicals that are contributing to the global warming.
Well, that is a unique suggestion. When the volcano at Krakatoa blew up in the, I think, 1820s, Amherst, Massachusetts, in August, recorded temperatures, I think, in the 20s. And there was no growing season anywhere. Hard to see how that would be good, but it's your theory that somehow that would mitigate the buildup of greenhouse gases.
I mean, instead of trying to figure out how to make volcanoes explode, maybe we should think about controlling the burning of the fossil fuels in our sort of our own volcanoes, these power plants, and the cars and trucks that we drive around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let me comment on this, because there's a whole long discussion of it in the last 20 years under a different name called geoengineering.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is not that you'd fool around with volcanoes, but you'd have a human volcano, except you wouldn't do it in one blast. What you'd do is take the old guns of the battleship Missouri and turn them up toward the sky, and you'd load them with dust instead of with explosives, and ship them up there, and then inject 10 million tons of dust a year to reflect away several watts of energy. A couple of watts is like a little Christmas tea bulb, over every square meter of the Earth, and that would about balance the heating from greenhouse gases. And in fact, people even calculated you could do it at maybe $5 a ton of carbon, whereas if you want to do it by conventional means, it's more expensive. This is the kind of argument you hear. The problem is that we'd have to have a cadre of climate controllers doing this every year for the next 200 years at least. Now, what's the prospect, if we look back in the 20th century, that we'll have a continuous level of world peace where we'll be able to trust the climate controllers to be continuously injecting dust in the stratosphere as a counteraction to this thing? To me, it's methadone instead of proper cure to being on heroin. The heroin, in this case, the carbon in drug that we're all locked into from the Victorian Industrial Revolution. That having been said, there is one form of so-called geoengineering that I think makes a lot of sense, which is if you're going to take the hydrogen, which we could use in cars, because I completely agree with David Doniger that we need to improve the efficiency of our cars. One way to do that is to move toward fuel cell power plants instead of these Victorian machines, these internal combustion engines. And to do that, we need a supply of hydrogen. You can get it from methane, from natural gas, but if you do that, you produce carbon dioxide. What are you going to do with carbon dioxide? And the suggestion has been made, maybe dump it back under the ground from whence it came. So if you can find a safe way to do that, that is to close the industrial cycle, then you can get around injecting it into the air. So there's plenty of room for clever engineering and the kinds of ideas John was thinking about, but I wouldn't do it so much through the human volcano. I'd do it through getting the industrial cycle cleaner, and I think that with some incentives, which is why you need a Kyoto or a Kyoto-like mechanism, we'll start to invent those a lot faster.
Mm. And so we won't have to be using the mighty Mo to blast dust into the air.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's likely. I mean, are you going to trust that we'll have 200 years worth of continuous global cooperation on how to do that?
No, 2 months would surprise me. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. In a sudden reversal, the Bush administration has said global warming is real. It blames the global warming on the burning of fossil fuels, and it says global warming will create environmental havoc, but recommends doing very little about it. Live with it, the administration says. And the president has disavowed or dismissed his own administration's admission, apparently, that global warming is happening. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Are you ready to run up the white flag to global warming? Christopher is on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. I've been listening right along here. I think that the greenhouse gases is only a partial solution. Being a student of history of many different periods, it seems to me that the global warming problem is pre-industrial.
Pre-industrial.
You think about in this area, in New England area, that a lot of our best Indian sites are on the continental shelf because the level of the water has lifted over time. When you think about when they overfly deserts in North Africa, they can see the remains of cities that were there that have disappeared because
okay.
of the because I think deforestation is something we don't pay attention to, and our addiction to blacktop.
Yeah.
That we're basically paving everything, and you think about if you want to build a solar collector, you build it out of something black. And think about if you go to Washington, D.C., and you stand in D.C., then drive across the river and stand in the forest,
yeah.
and you can see that there's a drastic difference.
Well, what's your question here?
Well, it's not really a question, just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment is that that deforestation and blacktopping everything is not a helpful thing.
Right.
When the Dutch elm disease wiped out the elm trees on mm-hmm. Main Street USA everywhere
mm-hmm.
in the 50s, we left everything in the sunlight.
Right.
We didn't put the cover back over.
Right, right.
Christopher's got some interesting observations there.
I mean, David
Donovan. A program called Cool Communities,
mm-hmm.
which is embraced by Chicago and a number of other cities. And it's as simple as changing the black tops to white top and planting more trees as a measure to cool down the local environment. But if you want to cool down the global environment or prevent it from continuing to overheat, then we have to deal with what's driving it. Cutting down the trees and releasing the carbon from trees into the atmosphere is one thing, but the dominant thing is burning the trees that became fossil fuel millions of years ago at such a fast rate.
Mm-hmm.
We have to use the American know-how and technology that we are so proud of to reduce the amount of this fossil fuel that we have mm-hmm. to use mm-hmm. in order to meet our energy needs. And
yeah.
we can do it.
Christopher, thank you. Stephen is on the line. Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm wondering why we don't use the power of economics to our benefit. I think our government has a terrible record on regulation, but we're relatively good at money transfers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we ought to be raising the price of gas with a tax, probably dramatically. I hate taxes as much as the next guy, but that one would stop us from getting into our car to drive to the corner drugstore to buy a quart of milk.
It sure would. So what would you say about that, Stephen Schneider? Gas taxes, how high would they have to go to have a real effect, and what would that effect be?
Well, I wouldn't do just gas because, you know, that selects out one issue from many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about dumping carbon in the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
and we're using the atmosphere as if it's a free sewer. It'd be as if somebody came to pick up your garbage and they didn't charge you to pick up the can.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put out a second can, there was no additional charge for that. Why is it that my tailpipe or your smokestack is free? It's a violation, in fact, of the principles of the free market. Economists call them externalities because they're external to the normal calculations of business, but they belong internal, and it's a job of government to internalize them.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely agree with Stephen that we need to have a charge for what we're doing, so through a polluter pays principle, you can reduce the emissions and provide incentives. But there's a catch, and the catch is that rich people have more disposable income, and it means less to them to pay a little higher price at the gas pump or in other activities which has energy than poor people. So there's been some opposition that this is not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And one proposal that's been made by a number of economists is called tax and recycle. That is, if you tax the bads, the emissions into the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
but you recycle by lowering the general income tax or the tax on labor, for example, or on products, at the other end, you can have a revenue-neutral tax that
mm-hmm.
sets the right signal toward dealing with the environment and at the same time means that you have a very efficient way to send signals
mm-hmm.
to people to both build new technologies that are more efficient and at the same time not dump. The problem is what we talked about earlier, there will be losers in that.
Yes.
And we know who they
sure.
are, and they know who they are.
Yes.
They tend to be in the heavy polluting industries.
Right, right.
And therefore, they are heavily organized,
right.
heavily lobbying,
right.
and frankly, running disinformation campaigns about this problem in order
sure.
to try to protect their market share, even though the overall winner would be the country and the world, and most of the people who are the winners don't know it and are sort of out there flopping loose.
Yeah. Thank you. Will is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering what you think about the possibility that at some point the problem will become acute enough to where people start to really reconsider nuclear power, if not as a very long-term solution, but just as a sort of a bridge until we can get to these things, you know, like solar and wind and whatever that might be in the far future.
Okay, let's take that. David Doniger,
yeah.
Nuclear power.
I think that if you're looking for the cheapest way to meet our energy needs as an alternative to fossil fuels, you find that that nuclear power is not high on the list. What you find, at least for new nuclear power plants, what you find beats new nuclear power plants hands down are wind farms. Wind is almost as cheap as a source of electricity now as new natural gas plants. In some parts of the country, they're competitive. In energy efficiency, using light bulbs and machines and motors that just suck less electricity to do the work is a very cheap way to meet our needs. The Bush administration just a couple of weeks ago weakened an energy efficiency standard set by the Clinton administration for new central air conditioners. The old administration would have raised the efficiency of central air conditioners by 30%. The new administration cut that back to merely 20%. The difference is an awful lot of new power plants have to be built to power the air conditioners that would otherwise have been more efficient. And that costs everybody money, and it costs us all more global warming.
Now, the gap between reason and policy. How about this? How about nuclear power, just briefly, Stephen Schneider, that as a bridge technology?
Well, I agree with David that on costs alone, it's not immediately very competitive. Then there are some health, safety, and security issues associated with it. But I wouldn't, you know, instantly, you know, join on the no nukes bandwagon, just as I, you know, never joined on the no new taxes bandwagon. That's just sort of ideology. The real question is, can we make safe and efficient power? Right now, it doesn't look to me like nuclear is going to be that one in the short run. But over the long period, we have to not just cut our CO2 emissions by 10 or 20% in the next 10 years. We have to cut by 50% in the next 50 years and down to zero by the end of the century. We'll be looking at doubling, tripling, or quadrupling of CO2, which is not, in my opinion, a very nice legacy to leave to our next several generations.
Right, and it raises the issue of irreversibility.
That's correct, and therefore there will be reconsideration in the very long term, in my opinion, of nuclear power, but it'll have to solve two very important problems, which will be safety and security. And those are not cheap, and I don't see it as a major component in the short run, although I wouldn't write it off in the long run if some of these problems get done. However, to do that, it's very, very unlikely that many industries are going to make that investment. So it's going to end up being a subsidized investment by the government, and it's just amazing that the government will consider subsidizing that, and it's all reluctant that it's a violation of the market to subsidize renewables and efficiency.
Isn't that something? Just briefly, David Dunning.
Yeah. Every homeowner understands what happens when you just don't look out ahead. If you don't fix your roof, your house gets wet when it rains. If you leave the water running in the tub, it overflows. We have to look
ahead. Our cup runneth over right here, David Doniger. Thank you very much. David Doniger is Policy Director of the National Resources Defense Council Climate Center. And Stephen Schneider, thank you. He's a professor of biological sciences with the Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on forums. In a moment, capturing global warming on film. This is On Point. Like all of us, Gary Brash has heard the same debate over global warming for years, but to him, the numbers and the scientific musings were missing the point. Real changes were happening to the Earth, and he set about documenting them. With his camera in hand, Brash has traveled from the Arctic Circle to the rainforests of Costa Rica to ice shelves of Antarctica, taking photographs that capture global warming's impact. In this radio diary, he discusses why, in the global warming debate, a picture is worth at least 1,000 words.
I envisioned this as a document that would actually show people the changes, if I could show the changes, but certainly to show them the landscapes that were changing and what the work of the scientists actually looks like. part of this was driven by the fact that I am a journalist, and so I did see that this was going to be a story that was going to be repeated in many forms over and over again, and that there were not very many photographs available of the actual studies. I tell people, think back about the stories of climate change. Typically, they're illustrated with stock pictures of like a blazing sun or a cracked mud on the bottom of a lake or something like that. Symbolic, yes, but not really indicative of the actual studies that are happening. So I set about to see if I could illustrate the studies and help focus people's attention on what was really happening. It is, in fact, impossible to show in one photograph that a bird species, for example, has changed its range or that a particular plant is blooming earlier than it has. But there are things that are visible. For one thing, that's just been happening and in the news is that there have been a tremendous amount of loss of ice shelves in Antarctica. So I actually have pictures of what it looks like to be at the face of an ice shelf with it disintegrating all around you with icebergs everywhere and so forth. Another one that's quite important and relatively easy to document is the change in glaciers. Glaciers have been photographed since the beginning of the century, and so it's possible to get old pictures of glaciers. And I've been working on this. I have several of them on my website with a little rollover feature, so you can go from around 1850 in the Alps to what the glacier looks like now. It's almost just totally disappeared. Antarctica is the most amazing place that I've ever seen. It is a dramatic place. The pictures that you see, they look astounding. They look unbelievable. You wonder how anything could survive there. Those feelings are magnified tenfold by when you actually see it. And to realize that within the Antarctic landscape, there are many habitats, to see how wildlife has found a niche there amongst all that ice and frozen landscape is one of the most amazing, very heartening emotions I've had. So from glaciers up in the high Andes above 15,000 feet to the shoreline of the ocean, and in fact into the ocean, is the kind of range of places that I've been trying to get to photograph. From the polar areas, one picture that helps people understand it a lot is a photograph of a geologist in Alaska who is showing graphically how far the permafrost has melted back in a site that he's been monitoring for 20 years. He's showing that the permafrost has actually melted and sunk down almost a yard since he put his sensing device into the permafrost 20 years ago. That's an image that people can see a change. And in the Antarctic, apart from the ice shelf images, the images of an ornithologist standing in an empty rookery where the Adelie penguins have been forced to move over the last 25 years because the climate there is no longer the best for their eggs developing, which means that the babies don't mature and come back to the same spot anymore. And so slowly but surely, this particular rookery is being depopulated because of climate change. And the image of the ornithologist standing in this empty rookery is somewhat poignant. You have to say what's happening, but it's easy for people to see that a change has occurred there in a matter of only about 25 years. I think that it's having an effect on people who see the pictures, and I hope later we'll have more of an effort to connect up with policymakers. Part of my work is not only to take beautiful and meaningful pictures, but also to try to put them in a context and to tell a story with them. So I definitely would like my work to reach everyday people, but also I hope that some of my work might influence policymakers who might feel more convinced that it is an issue and take more action.
Gary Brosh is a photographer based in Oregon. To view photos from his Worldview of Global Warming project, visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is W.